Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important. This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Hello and welcome to Catharsis, the show where I provide therapy for my guests. A chance to talk about old grudges, petty gripes, unpopular opinions, and other people's problems. This week, I'm joined by comedian and writer Athena Kublenu. However, before we get into her gripes, one of mine. In my sad attempt at New Year's resolutions, I've been to look at a gym, and I just can't do it anymore. I want to, but I can't because I went in and there were women on the machines in full makeup, and I cannot handle that pressure. Like, I thought the gym was where you went to get to look better, not where you have to go to look good in the first place. Like, I get it that everywhere is a pickup place now, but I don't want to be sweating and crying next to someone in false eyelashes and a clip-on ponytail. I can't do it. I don't want to look at someone in full matching Lululemon rolling around on a yoga ball while I fart my way through some kettlebells, because that's the reality of the gym for me. And I don't have it in me anymore. Is it that everything needs to be Instagrammable now? I presume next time I have a shit, I should be posting a photo of me in full makeup doing it. I just have decided that I'm going to have to stick to doing yoga at home, doing weights in the garden.
Tiff, let's go to the gym together. Okay. Let's wear 100% cotton shirts, that sweat mark the hell out of, you know, let's get the bum sweat line, you get the fanny sweatshirt. let's fix this, because I used to go to gym a lot, right? I was a gym rat and then I stopped when I just got too busy with like kids and stuff. So I kind of missed those years where the gym transformed. So it's almost like, you know, if you leave a country and you come back and it's like a new government and a new authority. That if yes. I go back to the gym, I'll be you. I'll be like, what happened? Because I used to go to the gym looking, I'd have my do-rag on to stop my sweat. And I go to the gym to train, you know?
Yes.
It's a place where you work. I think we need to open a new chain of gyms where you're not allowed in if you look like you've looked in a mirror before you left your house. Okay, that's what we need. It needs to be like the gym group for people who come to use the gym. And that's it. So it starts right here. Dragon's Den, we want the money, because that's just a hostile environment to me. Horrible. Hostile. No one should look good in the gym. If you look good in the gym, you're wasting your time and my time. You're wasting everyone's time. Stop it.
As you're aware, Athena, this is the podcast where I will provide some kind of therapy, completely unqualified. So I normally ask my guests at the top to bring along an old grudge, something they've been thinking about. It's been weighing you down from your past. Let's see if we can fix it. Hit me up.
I had to think hard about this gripe because I'm not sure that I hold grudges, but I definitely have a very bad memory. So I forget a lot of the times that I've been wronged purely because I just have a really bad memory. But I remember this one. When I was in my first year at uni, I lent somebody who will remain nameless a copy of the book Roots, which is like a book which everyone knows. And that was like a particularly special book to me, because it was a secondhand copy that was bought for me by an uncle of mine. His name's Uncle Jim, right? And he passed away. And he'd inscribed it really simply to Athena from your Uncle Jim, and he dated it. Now, being me and being at university for the first year, I thought you just lent stuff to people and they give it back to you. I'd led a fairly sheltered life up to that point. Like, I would give, you know, me and my... I was really lucky. I went to school with people who I got on with. So I had like a good group of friends in London who I knew from school and college and from where I lived, and I'd never, the concept of giving something to someone and not getting it back, it never really came to me. So I gave somebody this incredibly sentimental piece of work, and it was before the summer holidays, right? It's before summer break. So after summer break, I was like, where's my book? And this person was like, I moved house and I lost it. Just like that. But like, that's how it was delivered. And, oh my gosh, it was like the most normal thing in the world to this person to take this thing and lose it. But here's the crazy thing. I was a bit upset, but because I'm very stoic, I was just like, oh, okay. And she was like, oh, actually, wasn't it? Didn't it have like an inscription on it? Didn't someone sign it? And I was like, yeah, my Uncle Jim gave it to me and, you know, he signed it. And she was like, oh, okay. Like, there was no acknowledgement. And That's when I learned my circle is too small. I need to widen my circle and realize to expect much less of people in the world. And I think that's what happens when you spend a lot of time, when you spend your whole life with people you've known for years and years and years, you forget that some people are just horrible. By the way, this person isn't horrible, and this was a long time ago. We were 18, 19.
It's careless. It's very careless.
Yeah.
And I like that you're qualifying it with, like, because that is a thing of, like, when I say grudge, people are like, I don't like to hold grudges. And, you know, we're going to be talking about her later on in the podcast. But I think I remember Maya Angelou saying first, you know, holding a grudge is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. Mm. You know, I get that. But I do think sometimes it's quite healthy to go, oh, actually, what lesson did I take from this going forth into the world? So you were saying about your circle being quite small and intimate. And for a lot of people going to university for the first time is the first time that you're going to meet people who don't necessarily share your values, who don't necessarily think the way you think. And that's part of the joy of it. But not understanding the sentimentality of something or being very laissez-faire about a book that has meaning and sort of power in it anyway is fuck that girl.
are you a therapist? Because the way you've put it out like that, like it's been like 22 years and I've never really processed it in that way. Even though that's what I said, that was a really concise way to put it. Yeah. But then, like I said, like, she's actually all right. Like I think she wouldn't do that now. This is very much something that is part of being an 18 and 19 year old. But it was definitely very naive of me, I think, to give something to someone who was going to take it from that city, take it to another city, and then bring it back. Because I would have just kept it. Like, I would have. I remember a friend of mine lent me a copy of the Quran, right? And, you know, she's not Muslim, but her family's Muslim. And I just always wanted to just read it. And I know the Quran is a very precious thing. You got to keep it above head height and all these things. I swear down, I don't know where that Quran is. All right, I lost the damn Quran.
Okay.
When I tell you, I still apologise to this girl every time I see her. I'm so, you know, and I lost it bizarrely enough because it was in my house for ages, and then I moved out, but it stayed in my house, and then I went back to my mum's house. So like, it was in my mum's house, and I moved out, and I came back, and it just wasn't where I thought it was. And lots of things were cleared out by my mum and my older brother and things like that. And I'm utterly convinced that they just put it in a box and gave it away because that's what family members do. And it was a really horrifying thing. And she was like, "It's fine." Like she gave it to me because it wasn't a sentimental thing. It was just something that she had, and I saw it at her house. I thought I'd quite like to just have it.
You can see behind me, there's books stacked up. So a couple of things I want to say. If there's anyone out there listening, if you have seen a copy of Roots knocking around with a message from Uncle Jim, can you please get it back to Athena?
In blue ink pen. You know, like those kind of liquid
fountain
ink pens.
Fountain pen.
Yeah, but fountain it wasn't a fountain pen, yeah. It was that ink. I remember it. I remember the inscription, his handwriting and everything. Yeah, if you have it, I'd love it to come back to me. That'd be awesome.
Yes, imagine that. And then you could find out the journey of that book years later, because the beautiful thing about books is that could have gone into the hands of 10 people who needed to read it before it finally comes back to you.
Right. And it's a transformative book as well.
Here's what I would say. And I love this because it's very tenderhearted of you. I remember one of my early experiences of a similar thing was at junior school, where we did swaps, and I thought swaps was for like a week and I just never got back. I think I had like a new Cindy doll. I don't think it was Barbie, with all of her outfits and everything. And this other girl at school had a Tinkerbell perfume, and I took it home and my mum went absolutely ape. She was like, "I cannot believe you've done that." I got like told off from my mum, and I was like, "Oh no, it's only for a week." And then I went to take it back in, and I just never got my doll back. And I would rather be that person. I would rather you be that person that is willing to openly lend something or be the person that goes, "Sure," you know, than be the person who goes, "No, you're going to lose it," and sort of close that aspect off. So I'm thinking, I'm hoping, if you do feel a bit better, now you've got this off your chest and it's out there, then we might get this book back. If this podcast could do that, how incredible would that be?
Oh, Tiff, I would just, I don't know what to say. I would burst into tears. I would. Could you imagine that? The book could be estate by now, because that book, it was secondhand when I got it, and I got it when I was 13, 14, you know?
Right.
So you can imagine how old this copy would be. And it was, you know, all brown paper. It was a very well-read book. So I don't expect to get the whole, I'd get 20% of it back. It'd be like the cover in a few pages probably.
Where did it start? So where did you lend it at university?
Birmingham, and it went back to South London, went back to Croydon.
So we know it started in the Midlands, went to somewhere in South London. Yeah. If you see it, let's find it.
I'm looking at your bookshelf going, is it in the Muswell Hill somewhere? But
yes, yeah, like it could be. It could be behind me here. I mean, I think that this is what I love. This is why I have a Kindle, but it's, I feel like, how sad does a bookshelf look with one Kindle on it?
Oh, no, listen, I've got a big, I think books are amazing. Like, one of the reasons why I lent the book out, and I still do, is because I'm like, if I read a book, I just want, you know, and you have like a mutual who would like it, you pass it on. I think books are the one thing where you could, if you don't have any money, go into an overdraft for a book, because it's the one, when you pass away, that's the thing that it lives, you know, it's not waste. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's not like buying like a pair of trainers or like a car. And people always want books. I know that sounds... Anyway, I think books are great.
I love secondhand books.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And I like the messages in them. I've got some mad ones back here. But I found one that was from like 1910 or something. And it had in it, thank you for a wonderful Christmas and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's a really sweet message. Like, from one... I think it was like two lovers.
Oh. And
so I think... So I like that. I like that a book has a journey, has a history.
There's a reason why the Kindle couldn't kill the book, right? Because it's just, books are just like, just there's nothing like holding a book and passing it on to someone. So when I go, there'll be so much stuff that ended up in a skip. I promise you, no one puts books in a skip. And if they do, yes. I mean, if you're right now putting books into a skip, like, what's wrong with you? Like, no one puts books in a skip. No one, for a reason.
This section of the podcast we like to call Unpopular Opinions. Something you love but everyone else hates, or vice versa.
Sit down if you're in North London, because you're not going to like me.
I'm in North London, yeah. I'm sat, I'm
everyone
ready.
Everyone listening to this in North London, sit down, you're not going to like this. I, sadly, in spite of him and his politics, do not like Jeremy Corbyn. I didn't like him when he got elected. I thought, I was one of the people that thought he's not really electable because I know the British public. Not because he's not a nice guy. Not because he has bad politics, but I know the British public. I found him, his leadership, to be weak. I found him to be stubborn. I found him to be unstrategic. And I was proven correct over two elections, because he lost two elections. And I struggle a lot with the way people don't see his flaws, because we need to get rid of this government. And if we're not honest about our opposition, we might actually end up with another version of this current government, which is literally destroying this country, like, in a way that I think is easy to underemphasize. Jeremy Corbyn is not, and our insistence that he was a brilliant person, that is not the way for us to make this country better right now. And it's really frustrating, because I feel like I'm very rash, I'm always very rational about this when I talk to people like this. I only get trolled by people like Jeremy Corbyn. You know, oh, trans rights, no one cares. You know, but Jeremy Corbyn, well, my mentions get set ablaze. And it's really odd, because I'm like, the Tories have a majority and they're doing what the hell they want with it because of his leadership.
I agree with you 100%. We have to be critical, realistic, be able to view our flaws if we are to beat the party that's in power. That now we're at the point where I feel like we're living... And this isn't right, that we're like expected to live like a page out of a Samuel Pepys diary, you know, like that we're supposed to live in this kind of austerity. We've got to watch Jamie Oliver tell you how to like use less gas on the hob.
Yeah.
So that your heating bills don't, it's not, and it's been normalised to such a degree that food banks, you know, are not just necessary, but encouraged. Mm-hmm. And then people who are working for blue chip companies and corporations who are also using food banks in for, like, this is not normal. And so we've gone so far beyond normal with such a destructive party in power that we need to be very, very aware.
We can't afford now to kind of be ideological about our politics. We kind of have to be realistic. I did find Jeremy Corbyn to be very ideological. What I think sums up Jeremy Corbyn is this statement. I actually don't think he's racist, but I do think he's very bad at telling people he's not, which is really just as bad. Like, it should really be the easiest thing in the world to say, oh, actually, I'm not a prejudiced person. And the way he kept comparing anti-Semitism to all other kinds of racism, I think was really hurtful. What people always forget about anti-Semitism, which really frustrates me, is that it predates racism. People were anti-Semitic before they even saw themselves as white. okay, before the definition of whiteness existed, they were like, by the way, we don't like Jewish people. Like, this, it's millennial. Yeah. It's a we're talking about millennia here. I always say you have to understand the precise context that anti-black racism occurs in. I have to then say I've got to understand every other distinct racism, which means I've got to understand how anti-Semitism is a different kind of racism to, and that's why I have a different name for it. It's, you know, that's why I'm very clear when I say, when I talk about racism, I like to be, we're talking about anti-blackness or we're talking about anti-Semitism, because it is different. And I do believe that the resistance that people have to believe in the prevalence of anti-Semitism is anti-Semitic, right? Like, if a black person comes out and says, oh, something's racist, that people like to nod and agree, like, yeah, it's racist. So why did we have this problem when it was the Labour Party? People were really dense. They thought, how could you have a leader of a world power? But bizarrely, Britain is still a world power. I don't understand it either. We only just started doing well at Eurovision. In them days, we wasn't even winning Eurovision, right? But how could people think we could have a leader that doesn't believe in the existence of a country? He couldn't come out and say Israel has the right to exist. You can say it has the right to exist, but you can also say it shouldn't be oppressive. Those are very simple things to say.
Yes, you can hold to those two beliefs at the same time.
Yeah.
And there are lots of Jewish people that do.
So many, you know, I make a real point of amplifying Jewish people who are pro-Palestinian, because I think that's a better way to have that conversation, as it happens, on my socials, Athena Kvenu, Instagram, Twitter. like that. Activism and self-promotion at the same time. Listen and learn. But it's a really good point. Like, it's a completely, I think Israel should exist. If Jewish people can't settle in Israel, where the hell do they settle? Everywhere they've been throughout the last 2,000 years, they've been told to fuck off. Literally.
I guess there's lots of people that think it started with World War II,
right,
and that we have Holocaust denial on such a, like, as an almost like everyday occurrence.
There's this mythology that Israel exists because of the Holocaust. Like, Israel exists because of British colonialism. Okay, like, if we're going to talk about Israel as a formative country, let's talk about it as it was formed, because Palestine was a part of the British protectorate. So let's talk about that. So if we want to talk about colonialism, I'll have that conversation. But people are like, well, you know, they had the Holocaust and they got given Israel. Like, that is not true. It's not history at all. That's made up history. That comes from your anti-Semitism. So anyway, there was a lot of stuff that Jeremy Corbyn could have said out loud in defense of Jewish people and to highlight misconceptions that people have that probably don't come from anti-Semitism. It just comes from misinformation. But he never did that. He just walk around going, well, you know, all racism is bad and stuff. So he was really bad at telling people he wasn't racist. And then he just had, like, too much faith in the British public, and that comes from stubbornness. He was like, well, I'm a good person, I want good things, so people will like me. It's like, on what planet do you live on? Do you know what I mean? These people cancelled Phil and Holly, you know, like, they have no time for you. They don't give a shit. They will cancel anyone.
Well,
you know,
and it's very easy to dismiss as well, I guess, because feeling like a Labour Party that properly advocates for the working class in a way that for the last while it feels like it hasn't as much.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. You know, like, we're looking at a Labour Party now that sort of is a bit wishy-washy on supporting strikes.
I actually kind of didn't have a problem with Keir Starmer saying, I don't want MPs on a picket line, because I don't think it helps. Like, if an MP's on a picket line, who cares? So I kind of didn't worry about it. But you're right, he should have been more proactive in balancing that with, by the way, the strikes are great and amazing. But, you know, for me, I don't think it matters if an MP's there or not. With Jeremy Corbyn, you're exactly right. He really struggled to give working class people an incentive to vote for him. I'm not saying working class people aren't compassionate people, but I'll be honest with you, most working class people are too busy to care about polar bears and climate change, you know? And if you open the Labour manifesto, which, by the way, no one did because nobody reads manifestos, but I did it, the first like 5 pages were on climate change. You know, what do we care about? We care about the cost of childcare. We care about the cost of food. We care about our living conditions. You know, we care about damp and we care about housing. And I think when the whole broadband thing didn't work and they were shocked, it's like, when last did you wake up and think, boy, talk ripping me off? Like, no one, when last did you think that? Like, it was like, you were absolutely right. If everyone in this country had free broadband, that would be a real equaliser. But in terms of capturing my imagination and making me think, we want you to be leader, it's literally like, I can't remember. I just don't go to bed dreaming of Vodafone. Like, I just don't do it. I don't wake up thinking about BT. I just, it's other things. So he was really bad at understanding how to talk to people.
I mean, there's a balance as well, isn't there, of local and global issues, you know, and almost, I can't believe I'm actually going to defend Rishi, but when they were talking about the G8,
they kicked out Russia, so G7 like, again, because they kicked out Russia.
G7. Was like, we've got stuff to deal with at home, which I sort of understood. I was like, of course you need to be there.
Yeah.
But of course there is a thing of like, when people are really struggling, they're like, can we, right now, can we be afford to looking outward globally at these things when I can't manage what's going on in my house and I can't pay my heating and I can't. I'm desperate to see someone who truly taps, and I don't even know if Keir's there. Like, I don't mind Keir, like, you know, I think broadly. But someone who really is able to go, we're listening to you. Because we can say we're global, but you do have to kind of start with, what do your constituents, what do your people need? And then we look outwardly beyond that. I don't feel that there's been anyone in recent times that's done that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that Labour, a lot of the Labour MPs who got kicked out in 2019, they said on the doorstep, Jeremy Corbyn was toxic. That's the leader of the party. So there's this real narrative that it was the mainstream media. But to be honest, the mainstream media only ever said out loud the things Jeremy Corbyn said, right? Everyone was like, there was a twist in it. Well, actually, he would say stuff and the media would say Jeremy Corbyn said this. I don't think, there was nothing I don't know about Boris Johnson's personal life. There's nothing. I know, against my will, I know all sorts. Okay, it's all against my will. I couldn't care less about the children, about bumping his wife who had cancer. Everything that has ever happened in Boris Johnson's life, which is mostly negative, has been reported in the press. Okay, so when people say the mainstream media, I'm like, what, the media that tells us what trash Boris was, who got elected? So this, yeah. There is. I do agree that when you are on the left of politics, you're going to have a hard time in the press. But I think that's an inconvenient and annoying truth rather than something that is stealing elections from us. That's just something we have to work into our strategies when we try to get elected. You know, the mainstream media, and ever since COVID's happened, like the Financial Times, the Times, they've been kicking this government constantly. Every week you will find an anti-government article, right? And yet people on the left will talk about the mainstream media hate the left wing, and it's like, well, I mean I'm sorry, I read the Financial Times, like, whatever, man, whatever. My partner has a fucking account, all right, I use it. But you will read just, and when the Financial Times kick you down, they use numbers. Do you know what I mean? It's not like they don't just go, you're a,
it's economics.
There's
baby,
a fucking graph that proves you're a, you know? So it's not the full story, although I will concede it as part of it. Do you know when the EHRC report came out a few years ago now and Jeremy Corbyn said, well, over-Semitism was overstated and he got kicked out of the party? That's when I knew he was not the one. Why would you say that? It's over. A line could have been drawn under the whole thing if he just said the report has come out and it's legitimised both sides of the argument, which was actually the best outcome. And he said, well, it was overstated. Get out of the party, Joe. I'm glad he's not in it, because why would you say that? Out and not retract it.
And that's why I would vote for Athena. Just there. But that's exactly it. That's where you come in and you go, I can now see that it's strengthened. You don't come out and go, actually, I think you're all overreacting.
Yeah. And what a kick in the face for Jewish people. It's really difficult, you know, if you're a Jewish person and you can see the country you live in and you're saying, I can't support this man. That's bravery. You know, there was a lot of anti-blackness in the Labour Party at that time, so I had to vote for those fuckers. You know, I wasn't brave enough to go, I can't do this. That's real bravery. And so, yeah, I definitely... Yeah, I don't like Jeremy Corbyn. Sorry, guys. Deal with it.
I want to talk to you about a topical news story that might be a bit stingy, that we can apply some cream to. That's why we call this topical cream. Tell me what's in the news, what's getting under your skin at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So as we have this conversation, we're having it 24 hours after the anniversary of Brexit, which is us leaving the EU, which was 3 years ago. I ummed and ahed about whether I should talk about this because it's so boring now. But it was really interesting to me to watch the celebrations of this anniversary with people from the government, particularly Rishi Sunak, going, yeah, it's really great, isn't it, Brexit? Isn't it brilliant? Aren't we having a great time? You ever been to like a party where the DJ's going, aren't we having a great time? And everyone is just like, why am I here? This is just the worst night of my life. No one's dancing. But you can see we're not having a great time. Literally, like, butter is £2.50. We're having a terrible time.
Brexit has been, from start to finish, a complete disaster. And it's a 3-year anniversary of us leaving. But there was also another 2.5 years before that of negotiations, and it felt like what was achieved? Like I once flirted with a gay guy in the office for like 2.5 years, and that was less of a waste of time, you know, than that entire negotiation period, where it feels like the emotional cost and the schism in culture and society, that everything is like, we do have to talk about it. It's been 3 years. We do have to bring it up, because kind of like lockdown, there has been a hangover from it. It's still affecting the conversations that we have, the budgets, what we're able to do. So the idea that we could celebrate this as some kind of, what's the net positive? Like, I would love someone to tell me what the net positive is from Brexit.
I have one positive. About a little while ago, I tweeted and I said, can someone tell me something positive that's happened because of Brexit? And someone piped up and said, well, now, because EU countries have to comply with our laws, they're not allowed to exploit chalet girls. You know how, like, you know what you do when you're like 18, 19, you go over to like a ski resort and you spend the winter there and you ski all day.
If you're called Annabelle,
yeah,
and you went to an all girls school, you would go over and
yeah, and you make a minimum amount of money, but you get paid in basically a season long ski pass, ski hire, and the relevant insurances. So you basically ski all day. You get a little bit of pocket money, and you have to cook for families, and you get like 1 or 2 days off a week. And I was just like, oh. Well, that was worth it. Like, nothing is working. Nothing works in this country. But like you said, Annabelle can get paid a living wage on her fucking gap year in the mountains. Yeah. And like, the whole point of being a chalet girl is that you just have that hedonistic kind of season snowboarding and whatever. So there hasn't really been a benefit. And I really hate the cognitive dissonance that the government is practicing, and it's not working on us, but that's why we're all striking. Like, it's not working. They're looking out the window and going, isn't the weather great? And it's pissing it down with rain.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah,
it's so annoying.
My shoes are full of water.
Yeah,
I really feel like, and I remember getting into, again, speaking about tweets that get you in trouble, I remember just post Brexit there was this big sort of drive, and again, what annoys me is it feels like it's a Tory, I feel like there's some kind of Tory bot farm that churns out these tweets. So they were like kind of like buy British. So people were going, but you can't buy British for everything. And I was like, that's kind of ironic, isn't it? That the only thing we're mass producing at the moment is government incompetence. So it's like a little joke. Like, and people went mad going, you hate British business. And I was like, of course I don't hate British business, but I can see this for what this is. It's an attempt to spin Brexit, and then now we're in a situation where we can't, you know, get goods from the EU, stuff that you would normally buy online that you're going, oh, that's £90 now to just get it through customs, to get it through the door. So I can't. So I would love to buy British, you know, and I do buy British, but not everything that you want is available. People are going, bananas, are we going to start growing bananas?
Why would you want to just buy British all the time from this little island? We're a tiny, just look on the globe, we're a tiny, it's not even logistically possible to just buy, we're tiny. I don't even know where to start. I mean, why should I just buy British? And don't forget, yeah, like, and you will be buying British from a British retailer, or like, it's, yes, it's just a really myopic way to see the world, this idea of self-sufficiency. Why would you want to be sufficient? Surely it's about, and what if every country said, right, we're just going to buy from ourselves? Then who do you sell your stuff to? You don't have any right to have or desire an export market if you think that nobody should buy an externally from Britain. Well, fine, who's going to buy your shitty cheese then? No, yes. French want to buy French. They don't want your fucking stinking bottom from, like, whatever they call it. They don't want it. The Dutch want their Edam. They don't want your shitty little cheese strings. You know, it's just a really weird way of seeing. If we're going to sell stuff abroad, we have to buy stuff. I'm coming across as proper arsey, but there's a radio.
But that's kind of my point of, like, you can't, that doesn't mean intrinsically, because you can see what someone's trying to do, that you don't support British business.
Yeah,
and I do. And especially small businesses as well. There's loads of like jewelry companies and clothes shops and stuff that I buy from here. And actually the experience of going out to kind of shop. But if I'm ordering online, that's the one of the joys of being able to online shop, is to be able to get something from anywhere in the world, not even just the EU, you know?
We as a country, we didn't invent free trade, but we certainly pushed the world towards the idea of free trade, the idea of like selling, literally, I mean, this is very basic, but selling stuff to people and buying stuff from them is the way to create global wealth. And that's because we had a Commonwealth, basically. And it's just really odd that we've gone, oh, we've changed our mind. Like, but we've got this system. Like, we made these countries become, like, you know, specialized producer stuff because we said we'd want to buy it from you. And now I said, oh, we want to make it ourselves. But why would we spend the last 100 years making this country just make cocoa, or this country just sell coffee, or this country just do X, Y, and Z? You know, we made the Argentinians become a beef producer. That's the only reason why Argentina is really big on beef production, because we were like, we want you to grow our beef. And now, like, nope, we're going to buy British. Like, we've just made the whole economy.
Where are you going to get
us
the spices? Where are you going to get the tea? We run on tea. Yeah. Who's going to?
Well, exactly. We're going to. What will we drink? Fucking Robinsons. Hot Vimto. hot Vimto and cakes now at the Ritz instead of tea.
Hot Vimto and a chunk of cheddar, and that's all you're allowed. A cup of gravy.
It's a real mythology that a country can thrive, like, on its own, and it's a mythology that it would want to. Why? Well, like, all right, you can eat your beige food every day if you want, but I like to eat different stuff. So a very odd thing. I was listening to More or Less on, you know, Radio 4's got that show More or Less, where it basically does the maths and stuff, yeah? And this morning it was saying that yesterday they put out this data, like, there's never been any more exports and imports in and out of the EU from the UK than the last year. That's actually not the case. There's never been any more, but in case of value, because things cost so fucking much. So our imports and exports have gone up because everything's so expensive, but by volume it's gone down by like 40%. Like, this is genuinely true. Please listen to this show if you haven't listened to it. But it basically is like,
oh, so that
by
will
volume,
be the spin. That's the government
it's spin.
The spin.
By volume, we're putting out less and we're buying less because we're getting less for our money. But by cash, in cash terms, everything's great. And I feel like these mythologies that are circulating, I'm just actually just really tired of I'm so close to just walking out with a brick and just throwing it through the nearest window, because I don't know what else to do. I'm like, this is really bad, guys. And we're all suffering from it, all of us. I'm a middle-class person. I do very well, thank you very much. But I'm like, I'm literally swapping things out in my supermarket. You know, my kids are eating Tesco crinkle cut chips and not McCain, you know, which is obviously no hard, that's not traumatic for them. But I'm just trying to demonstrate that we're all having to cut back in a weird way.
Everyone, I think, on almost every level of society, apart from super rich, is now having to go. And sometimes people take the piss when they go, oh, is it affecting the middle classes? And you go, yeah, but also the middle classes put into the economy and a part of the circular, it's affecting poor people even more.
Precisely. You know? It's a real indicator of the effect. If we're struggling, I'm sat in my house with a hat.
it's exactly that. It's exactly that. Go, oh, we're supposed to care, and you go, yeah, because that's telling you that apart from the top percent, everyone is feeling the pinch. Everyone is feeling the strain from it. When we talk about all of this and the cost of living, I just feel like, again, the energy bills comparatively to the rest of Europe. I don't even know if we were still part of the EU whether that would affect our energy prices. At the moment,
that's a good question. I don't know, but I do know that if we didn't have so much energy dependency on Russia, which was a complete construct, we didn't need to be this dependent on Russia, but there was a quid pro quo thing. You know, we'll sell you all our property and you give us all your gas, fundamentally. That's it. And that's the crazy thing. Like, Russia invaded Ukraine and we have been told that we need to support that. And I guess we do. But Russia's gone, well, you can't have our gas now. And that's what happens when people go to bed with oligarchs and whatnot. And we always knew that Russia was gonna,
ironically, they got in bed with an oligarch to keep warmer. And it's turned out the other way.
It's a very high tog quilt though. High tog.
Time for historic beef. This is where we unravel or unpack a feud, a long-standing rivalry, or even an argument between some figures from the past. And this week I've chosen Maya Angelou versus unknown interviewer. I'm going to say unknown interviewer. I found this beautiful piece of footage where Maya was describing an interview she once had. Basically, I think she was nominated for a Pulitzer, and the journalist tried to do a bit of a gotcha on her by revealing that Maya had done sex work. And what I think is fascinating and interesting about this is kind of taking the power away from someone when they try and shame you. So it was done with the intent of taking this woman who just, you know, been acknowledged for this big achievement, and to kind of go, don't get too big for your boots. to just kind of like take that away. What I really love about it is that Maya obviously sort of says, well, there's more than one way to prostitute yourself, as I'm sure you're aware. And it's done in a very sort of classy way. And woe betide anyone who'd want to take Maya Angelou on in that way, because I think she always has such heartfelt and yet classy responses to people who try and bring her down. So that's what I wanted to bring to the historic beef for today.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's just a backhanded compliment, isn't it?
Yes.
Also, Maya Angelou is a survivor, okay? She's a survivor of sexual abuse, you know? So she has, like, her story isn't like, oh, I was born, then I was a prostitute, and then whatever. Like, she has a really complex history, and yeah, I mean, that's a backhanded compliment meant to undermine her and her achievements and what she became, you know, and the trauma that she came through. Why would you try it? Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Don't try it with her. Do you know what I mean? That was very poor judgment. Absolutely.
I think the one thing about her is that she's going to make you feel, I think the fear of having someone like Maya Angelou not like you is so like,
can you imagine? Oh my gosh. Oh
yeah. Like how you'd never get over that. Like if she sort of went, well, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed, which is what it feels like. I mean, I've seen her do various interviews with people. I remember seeing one of her and Dave Chappelle, and Chappelle was kind of so like nervous about going in with his opinion on something and was like, I feel embarrassed to say this to you. And she was like, it's okay, you know, you're my child, you're my brother, you're my son. And you can just sort of see him. There's something about her that's so graceful that I would love to, you know, I just think as human beings, if you're able to hold that space of... Also, she talked a lot about forgiveness, didn't she? Mm. And in her books, she's, in spite of what she went through, she wanted to forgive anyone who had wronged her. And I'm not that good a person.
Well, be forgetful like me. I don't forgive people. I just forget. I'm really bad. It's a terrible thing. But I think I think people really respect Maya Angelou, not only because she's wise, but she's really humble. So she talks very openly about mistakes that she's made and things that she regrets. And when you read that from her, and she does lots of interviews, and it's in her writing too, when you understand that she's able to admit her mistakes, but then like grow as a person, that's like very affecting, because we don't like to do that generally. So somebody who is 20 times the person that I am is able to wake up and say, I was wrong at that point, or I made a mistake. And it's like, doubling down is the new pandemic, you know. Doubling down is just, it's just shocking the way people will say, hear a very valid argument or a counterpoint to their view, and they'll just find, they'll either change the subject or whatever. And it's quite a thing. And she comes from a different generation, I guess. And yeah, I don't know who that interviewer was that thought that they could shame. And when you're being awarded, or when you're nominated for Pulitzer, you know, the disrespect, that's not like some shitty little, that's not Richard and Judy book club. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? That's not some little nonsense thing. That's a worldwide, if you've written something and you are nominated for that, or you win it, that means your book is going down in history. Your book is going to be handed down through generations and probably lost in Croydon somewhere. You know, like, that's a book that is just, that circulates through people's consciousness. It's historic. It's your legacy.
Yeah. And she was a great one for being able to, I think it's Gather Together in My Name, where she talks about all of that. And then she's sort of coerced into it the first time round from a man that she's with, because he gets into money trouble. So it's actually really nuanced and layered how she moved into doing that. And so I think to try and kind of gotcha someone by just dropping it in an interview, and I guess the intended effect is to make someone feel shame and fear.
Oh, it's shame. It's basically saying, you are now in a position that is intellectually stronger than me, and I don't feel comfortable with that because you're a black woman and you have this history that isn't like the quote-unquote proper history that you're supposed to have, that's supposed to get you access to this space. So I'm going to say this to write the world as so it can be as it is through my eyes. Does that make sense? And
yeah,
in those moments, those people need to be swatted like flies. They need to be swatted. Bang! All right? And she did that. And that's good, because it's unprogressive and also ungracious and fucking boring. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so boring. Should everyone who has a Pulitzer have been brought up in a three-bedroom, semi-detached house with a picket fence? Or no, like, actually, I don't want to hear those stories anyway. The irony of the, I think, of people who have traumatic lives is that would they create the art they created if they hadn't been through what they've been through? So I wouldn't wish her history on anyone, but would she be the writer she was if she hadn't gone through what she did? And we don't know the answer to that, but you have to respect people's past, you know, and that was very disrespectful of her journey. Yeah,
it's a deep insecurity. But I would like to pick up on the thing that you said about doubling down. I think that it's progressive to be able to go, oh, no, actually, I got that wrong. Yeah, I was wrong about that. And even sometimes people or thinkers or people in the discourse or commentators who I don't even particularly like or agree with will sometimes say, I got it wrong. And then I was like, oh, there's a level of respect. I don't know if I'd say that now or I disagree with that. Do you think that there is, that we're now in a society where it feels like the wrong thing to do to actually say, I got it wrong, or I'm going to climb down? Do you feel like the stakes are higher? Why is that? Why of her generation were people more like kind of understanding of being able to say, I got it wrong, or I misjudged that, or what? Why do you think that is?
I think it's indicative of the power of the personal brand. I don't think people are interested in not being cancelled. I think what they're interested in is putting their flag on a particular hill and then saying, come to my hill, and it becomes a performance to grow their followers. And I think that then trickles down into the behaviour of just people in general, aka their followers. If people were scared of being cancelled, they would process information and think and learn. So what they're afraid of is then losing their followers, I think. I honestly think it's as cynical as that. I think that it's a question of people taking a position and saying, this is my brand now. This is the brand that you'll see next to my avatar. And this is what my social media feed looks like. And it will maintain this tone and these opinions and these politics until I die, because this is how I accumulate followers. And people feel validated through followers now and not through intellectual enrichment. And I think that's the real issue that we have at the moment. I wish people were scared of getting cancelled, because then they would fucking think. Like Piers Morgan, for example. Piers Morgan shouldn't, on a rational level, an educated man who was a journalist by trade, shouldn't be tweeting, oh, those five black officers killed a black man, so it's not about racism. Like, are you dumb? Like, institutional racism is literally two terms that we have used to describe racism ever since 1994 and the report, the Stephen Lawrence report, okay? Like, how many times have I said it's institutional? Once you put on the uniform, once you work for the organisation, you practice its policies and its morality, right? We are all understanding of this. He should not be tweeting that, like somebody with his brain power and his qualification. So why is he saying it? Because he believes it? Or because
he knows it'll attract the most attention. And precisely, that's the damning thing about social media, is that it's very hard to capture anything with a nuanced debate, especially on something like Twitter. Or you could just say something outrageous. It feels like, yes, that would be... I'll come out and say something that's so obnoxious and so horrific because it plays to my base and it gets me the followers and it gets me attention. I've talked about this on here multiple times, but the death of nuance really is a thing.
Yeah.
And a sad thing for, like you say, for intellectual enrichment and progression and progressiveness.
It's frustrating. And there's people in my life, Sir Dan, who will have a thought like that and just DM me and be like, Fina, I'm really confused. And they will, and say, can you explain this to me? Because they know, you know, I guess I'm a student of racism, sadly. I read a lot on this stuff, and I literally am a student. I studied it, you know? So it's like, do that, Piers. Call your black friend. Oh, he probably doesn't have any, you know? But like, just text your black friend and be like, yo, this is really messing me up. Can you explain this to me? Because I promise you, like, that's cool to me, because it means when you speak in it publicly, you're coming from a more informed place. And that doesn't mean to say you ask your friends to do your labour for you, but you should have people in your life that you should be able to have these conversations with. And if they're real friends, they will have them with you. But that would be a great example of why things are the way they are. It's all about brand now, sadly, I think.
Thank you for coming on and sharing your unpopular opinions and your gripes and your beefs. I hope you feel a bit lighter.
I do. I do.
Like, we can't fix all the world's problems, but maybe we can feel better after getting it all out. Do you have anything to plug, Athena? Tell us what you've got coming up and where we can find you.
I've got a podcast. It's called Why Does My Child Hate Me? It's not just for parents and carers, though. It's for everyone. Because I if you care about that kind of stuff, but it's just about how wild humans are. We're so wild. Like, we're wild at 2 and 3, and we're wild for all our whole lives, and we need to acknowledge this. So it's really about that. And what else am I doing? The best thing to do is just find me on my socials. I never know what I'm doing. I just wake up in the morning and look at my diary, sadly. I think, oh shit, I should be in Bristol today.
So if you want live dates, head to Twitter, Instagram,
and my website. But yeah, that's...
What's your website?
It's just my name, athenacabeni.co.uk. But yeah, my socials are the best place to come say hi to me, I think, with your shitty opinions I can trash.
You can set fire to them. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on, Athena. I'm on tour from May, but actually there's one in March at Belfast at the Imagine Festival, which is a festival of ideas and politics. So if you're interested, come see me at that. Otherwise, I'll be all over the UK from May. You can get all of the dates on my Twitter and Instagram. Thanks again for joining us, Athena. Thanks for listening to Catharsis.
You can listen to other programs from The Bugle, including The Bugle, Catharsis, Tiny Revolutions, Top Stories, and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.